Blog Talk Radio.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, wake up, all the teachers, come to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. If we just let it be, na 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 na, the world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Need a little help, y'all. Yes, need a little help. Say it, boy.
Need some help, y'all.
Change the world what it used to be. Can't do it alone.
Can't do it alone.
Need some help, yeah.
Need some help, yeah.
Wake up, everybody.
Wake up, everybody. Welcome to MPH Radio on the 8th day of October 2022. Our theme tonight is HBCUs, Stop Being Football Sharecroppers. You listen to the voice of MPH Radio. We come to serve the underserved communities. We want to make sure that our history is told from our perspective and our story. And the only way and the best way we can do this is to have you to write your history. So we ask you today, come and join us in helping us to fill in our missing pages of history. Like always, our agenda for today's program will entail giving you something to think about as relates to freedom, Black Mini Facts, MPH Black Mini Facts by Susie, A Message to the Community by Alex Joyner, And our theme today, HBCUs, Stop Being Football Sharecroppers. And closing out is how you can help build MPH and MPH Radio. So that's our order for today's day. And if you have any comments, any questions you'd like to raise during this program, we encourage you by calling in at 818-337-0016. Hit 1, and we will acknowledge your last 4 numbers. So at this point in time, what we're going to ask you to do is take out a pen and piece of paper, and we're going to give you a little something to think about as it relates to this concept of freedom. Freedom is a concept that is often discussed, debated, fought over, and died over. And from day to day, from time to time, from year to year, from century to century, it may change. It may change. And from these changes, different people will have different response, which will trigger different actions. So it definitely is something worthy for us to gain a collective perspective of what it is, and how to best go about achieving it. But anyway, for real Lord Garrison, and when you talk about what is freedom to him, he gave a concept of whether there is a human being, I see God giving rights in her, in that being, whatever may be the sex or complexion. That was his concept of looking at this concept of freedom. Wherever there is a human being, I see God-given rights inherent in that being, whatever may be the sex or complexion. We and Lord Garrison, from Brother Martin Luther King Jr., he stated, we have learned to fly the airways like birds and swim the sea like fish, but we have not learned to learn the simple art of living together as brothers. Air abundance has brought us neither peace or mind, nor sincerity. Let me read that again to you from Brother Martin Luther King. We have learned to fly the air like birds and swim the sea like fish, but we have not learned to learn the simple art of living together as brothers. And abundance has brought us neither peace of mind nor sincerity of spirit. Martin Luther King, and the last one for today is from Muhammad Ali. He stated, he who is not courageous enough to take risks will accomplish nothing in life. He who is not courageous enough to take risks will not accomplish nothing in life. So those were some general definitions and concepts of what is freedom. You can share with us later what you think, what is your understanding of what freedom is. So at this point in time, like always, we're going to try to remind you of some contributions that our people have made to humanity by sharing with you some of our MPH Black Men in Facts. We will now bring in Susie, who will share with you some MPH Black Men in Facts. First and foremost, we'd like to welcome Susie to Missing Pages of History, MPH Radio. Welcome, Susie.
Good evening. The page today is coming from the PRSP.
Phone.
Oh, hello. Hello. Okay. All right. The first one is from, sorry for the technical difficulty, from Nat Turner, an African freedom. Anwar Sadat was assassinated in 1961, and he was the president of Egypt. Also, we have Fannie Lou Hamer, African-American freedom fighter, was born in 1917. On October the 7th, we had H.H. Reynolds, an African inventor, patent the bridge safety gate in 1890. Also on that date, Elijah Muhammad, African leader of the Nation of Islam, was born in 1897. And on the 8th, we had Jesse Jackson, African activist, was born in 1941. Let me repeat the many facts for October the 2nd. Nat Turner, African freedom fighter, was born in 1800. Guinea Political Independence Day was in 1958. And last and final mini fact for today, October the 8th, is the Mau Mau Rebellion in Kenya began in 1952. And once again, I apologize for the technical difficulties, but the mini facts came from the PRSP calendar of 2021.
We'd like to thank Susan for her MPH Black mini facts. And like always, what we're going to do right now, we're going to pause with music with a message. And when we return, we have a message from the community from Brother Alex Shawna. We'll be right back. This is MPH Radio.
I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside. Give them a sense, a prize, to make it easier. Let the children's laughter remind us how we used to be. Everybody searching for heroes. People need someone to look up to. I never found anyone who fulfilled my needs.
We'd like to welcome you back to MPH Radio. Find your strength. That's right. Find your strength. Some would say in the creator, but we also say in the people, the almighty people. There's nothing where organized collective cannot do. Again, this is the 8th day of October, 2022. Our theme tonight is HBCU, Stop Being Football Sharecroppers. That is coming up very shortly. But right now, like always, we want to teach a new way. And one of the ways we're going to teach it is through Alex Joyner, who is a writer, educator, and a thinker, who will be giving his perspective on a message to our community. So on that note, we'll bring in Brother Alex, and we would like to welcome him to MPH Radio. Welcome, Brother Alex.
Well, thank you, and I would also like to welcome, thank our guest speaker today, and anyone who calls in and gives their opinion, and let us know that what is on their minds, because what is on your mind also may be on ours. We just didn't say the question or have the idea that you did and want to share it. So I thank everyone for being a caller and holding on the lines and being patient, because there's much history to be learned today. Because we are in the midst of an election cycle where there is more lying and conning of the public for their vote happening than in any point in history. The worst of candidates with horrible backgrounds are harboring the worst of intentions once they get elected. They run rampant on the ballot in many states. Common decency and respect for your opponent is now lost on lies and deceit for power of being elected to office. Some of the candidates have mental issues and are lifelong racists who are still affiliated with the return of Jim Crow laws. Others are deniers of the last election as the party follows the liar in chief, who did not want a peaceful transfer of office from one president to another. We as voters had to decide the best candidates to lead and make the laws of the country. The consequences of not voting when America is in so much turmoil, of the search of truth from the bombardment of political ads, can be devastating. This is not the only time that the American people were lied to and misled by politicians running for office. Voters have made poor choices for the office presidents and other officials due to lies told by the candidate. We have suffered every time after bad choices of elected officials. The last poor choices are still separating and tearing the country apart with misinformation and lies of voter fraud. In 1966, a real party for the people was founded. It was the Tell It Like It Is party on the street, a party of over 70 branches in many cities that for more than 15 years would do what it promised for the people facing social unrest, poverty, segregation, joblessness, police brutality, and an unfair justice system. Poor education programs, unaffordable health care, and losing young men to the Vietnam War. Two young men who became tired of hearing the promises of a two-party system broke their allegiances and refused to beg for handouts from charities and the government and decided on a 10-point program to demand things like freedom to determine the destiny of the black community, economic empowerment through fuller unemployment and wealth redistribution, an education system inclusion of the black experience, and an end to brutality and fatal encounters between black people and the police. They started the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. That brings me to where the party's at. The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. As two young college students tired of hearing each candidate blame the other party for not doing enough for Negroes, colors, blacks, or African Americans in America, and then doing the same once they were elected, Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale met at Burdiff College in Oakland, California to discuss what they could do for their community. The lies told by the candidates for city, county, state, and federal elections of how they were going to change things were bold and full of hope. Once in office, though, they forgot the ones who put them there. The voters did not hold them accountable as they became corrupt from the power and influence and often did greater harm to the communities they swore to serve. The laws that voted for often disenfranchised the people of color even more. Something to be done. Oakland, like many American communities, was being overrun with drugs, the beginning of gang violence and shootings. Poverty was everywhere. Underperforming schools and joblessness gave little hope for a better life. The court system for blacks was unequal and one-sided. Despair and hopelessness filled the black community. Newton and Seale comprised and publicized a We Want It Now in a 10-point program for the followers who joined the group, and they listed it in the second issue of the Black Panther newspaper on May 15, 1967, and they were as follows. We want freedom. We want power to determine the destiny of our black community. We want full employment for our people. We want an end to the robbery by the capitalists of our black community. We want decent housing fit of human beings. We want education for our people that exposes the true nature of this decadent American society. We want education that teaches us our true history and our role in this present-day society. We want all black men to be exempt from military service. We want an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people. We want freedom for all black men held in federal, state, county, and city prisons and jails. We want all black people, when brought to trial, to be tried in court by a jury that peers groups or people from their black communities as defined by the Constitution of the United States. We want land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace. This list included many of the same things African Americans or black seeks today from their elected officials and government. They choose to act and organize in their communities throughout the world with social community programs like its Free Breakfast for Children program, whose success has shed light on the government's failure to address child poverty and hunger, pointing to the limits of the nation's war on poverty. The party taught and provided for children more effectively than the government. They were so successful at community programs that the police and federal agents regularly harassed and intimidated their programs, participants, supporters, and party workers, and sought to scare away donors and organizations that house the programs like churches and community centers. This organization, created by black men, patrolled the neighborhoods and streets and reduced crime and brought back black pride to many people throughout the world. The symbol of the clenched black fist became a mainstay in many expressions of black unity. It was adopted by the Panthers as a salute of freedom on the march. Black America no longer held their heads down, but looked up with a fist thrust high in the air to say that I am somebody. To ensure the proper education of black children, the Panthers also started after-school programs for public schools and liberation schools throughout the country with a focused curriculum on black history, writing skills, and political science. The first liberation school was opened by Richmond, California in 1969. Followed by another in Mount Vernon, New York, later that year. These schools or institutes also taught math, English, and science, but focus on the self-help and self-pride and being black, which is not being taught in white or integrated schools. Each one must teach one became a common model among their students. The successful programs of the Black Panther Party were so good that the FBI and the other government agents saw them as a threat to white America because the children and adults were being taught that African Americans could do for themselves. This was a direct threat to the capitalists who depended on taking the hard-earned wealth of the African-American citizens and using it to improve their lifestyle, had begun to destroy the myth that blacks were inferior to whites. When the Panthers began to arm themselves for actual self-defense, the harassment was increased to confrontations with the police and the FBI. For once, black people had an armed party who actually tried to help free them, not by force, but by the laws that stood for them. The government only saw that the party was moving too fast to establish equal footing for blacks and whites. Integration by most whites was seen as something forced upon them by the government as U.S. troops escorted black students into white schools. Dominantly black schools did not need an escort. The black schools welcomed them and made changes to accommodate them without incidents. Things changed for those predominantly African-American schools as their history was cast aside and forgotten. The Black Panther Party, they might not want these schools that had taught students from the Civil War to be forgotten history. They used them for after-school and summer programs with a focus on their past history. For all the good they did, no political party sought them out. They had many supporters and big donors, but the pressure from the government was too great. The leaders became marked men for life. Yes, listening to all the lies from all the political parties and candidates, I wonder, where is the real party for the people? At George Floyd's funeral in North Carolina, the new Black Panther Party stood proud and brought me back to a day when the meaning of black power truly meant something. When people respected and received the Black Panther Party in their homes, businesses, churches, and schools because they came to help and serve. This is something few politicians or government officials know anything about. Power to the people. And say it loud, I am black and I'm proud, was the cry on the streets of urban America. A model of self-pride expressed by the ones who wanted a better America. There will always be the real Black People's Party, and they will always have my vote, the Black Panthers. And I thank you, family, for listening.
We thank Brother Alex for his commentary to the community. And we would like to remind all those who are listening that the views expressed are the views of Brother Alex and not necessarily or so the views of MPH Radio or of any of its members or affiliate stations. We'd like to thank him for his commentary. At this point in time, you listen to the voice of MPH Radio. We're going to take a quick commercial break, a quick station break. We don't do commercials. We do station breaks. And when we come back, we'd like to have you chime in as we do our discussion today on our theme, HBCUs, Stop Being Football Sharecroppers. That's right. We want to have a critical discussion. We want you to put on your thinking cap and come back when we come back from our station break. This is MPH Radio. And we're going to fill in our missing pages today and come and help us.
I'm Change? I guess change is good for any of us. Whatever it takes for any of y'all to get up out the hood. I'm with you. I ain't mad at you. Got nothing but love for you. Do you think, boy? Yeah. All the homies that I ain't talked to in a while, I'ma send this one out for y'all. Know what I mean? Cause I ain't mad at you. Heard y'all tearing up shit out there. Kicking up dust. Giving a motherfucker. Yeah, nigga. Cause I ain't mad at you. Now we was once two niggas of the same kind. Quick to holler at a hoochie with the same line. You was just a little smaller, but you still roll. Got stressed to YA and hit the hood swole. Remember when you had a Jerry curl, didn't quite learn. On the block with your Glock trippin' on Sherm. Collect calls to the tilt saying how you changed. Oh, you a Muslim now, no more dope game. Heard you might be coming home, just got bail. Wanna go to the mosque, don't wanna take tail. It seems I lost my little homie, he's a changed man. Independent now, no sinning, it's the gang plan. When I talk about money, all you see is the struggle. When I tell you I'm living large, you tell me it's trouble. Congratulations on the wedding, I hope you're right. No, she got a player for life, and that's no issue. I know we grew apart, you probably don't remember. I used to be for your sister, but never ever. And I can see it's after school, we bomb. On the first one, up with thumbs with the bomb. But it's on, now the whole issue changed. And we don't even kick it, got a big money scheme. And you ain't even with it. Knew in my heart you was the same, up with thumbs the bad. Go toe-to-toe when it's off a road, you got a brother's back. And I can't even trip, cause I'm just laughing at you. You trying hard to maintain, then go ahead, cause I ain't mad at you. Mad at you. Cousins fighting, playing dozens, old neighborhood buzzing, knowing
that we buzz it, used to catch us on the roof from behind the stairs. I'm getting blitz and I reminisce on all the time we said. Besides pumping and grinding wasn't nothing on our mind. It's time we learn to live a life of crime. We grinded back to a time was much too young enough. I caught a felony loving the way the guns blow. And even though we separated, you said that you raised. Don't get nobody no coochie while I be locked up state. I kiss my mama goodbye, wipe the tears from my lonely eye. Said I'll return, but I gotta fight to get survived. Don't shed a tear, cause mama, I ain't happy here. I feel trial, no more smiles for a couple years. They got me going mad, I'm knocking busters on their backs. In my cell, picking hell, I know one day I'll be back. As soon as I touch down, I told my girl I'll be there. So prepare to get up down. The homies wanna kick it, but I'm just laughing at you. Cause you's a down ass hip, and I ain't mad at you. From a nobody nigga to the big man on the block. He's Mr. Local Celebrity, addicted to moving G, most hated by enemy, escaping the luxury. See, first you was out with him, but you made it. So the choice is made. Now we got who is why you faded. In a younger day, so full of pain when the weapons blade. Getting so high off that bomb, hoping we make it to the better day. Cause crime pays, and in time, you'll find a rhyme ablaze. You'll feel the fire from the niggas in my younger days. So many things on me, so many try to plot. But I keep a block atop my head, when will it stop? Your God return me to my essence, cause even as an adolescent, I refuse to be a convalescent. So many questions and they ask me if I'm still down. I moved up out of the ghetto, so I ain't real now. They got so much to say, but I'm just laughing at you. And just don't know, but I ain't mad at you.
That's right, we are not mad at you. This is MPH Radio. We're not mad at you because we need to come and stay together. And with that unity, we know all things are possible. Welcome back to MPH Radio. Right now, we'd like to make our transition to our theme tonight. And we'd like for you to just come in and join us by calling 818-337-0016 to discuss with us the thing that was recently podcast by Roland Martin and his podcast program, as they titled it HBCUs Stop Being Football Sharecroppers. We like to do our own critique analysis of this particular subject and fill in that particular missing page of history. And we'd like for you to join in by calling in and sharing your views and comments. Now, when I first saw that particular episode, there are so many angles one may would approach it from, but I'm just real curious in terms of the participants today and the members of MPH Radio, your perspective on one maybe the presentation of the subject. And I'm saying the presentation of the subject because we were taught a long time ago by Kwame Nkrumah that when it comes to the oppression of our people, African people, history becomes a very important weapon, a very powerful weapon, a very important tool that must be used, can be used to help liberate us as a people. And how history is presented to you also dictates and influences your perception of yourself and your people. So when I first heard this discussion by Deion Sanders, is the right for HBCU stop being football sharecroppers, you know, just the whole presentation of it, I was just wondering in terms of could have been a better way in terms of how we could present this particular argument. And I'm saying that from the point of view of if we accept the idea that our athletes and the HBCUs, historically black college universities, should receive more money for playing more wealthier and bigger universities, with the understanding that they will be publicly humiliated. If that is our major goals and focus and we don't have no problems with that, then are we saying that we too are using our youth as a pawn to be exploited and to be used by a few of us? So I would like to just have the premise of that discussion respond to. I'll start off with you, Brother Alex, because I just thought it would be interesting looking at the narrative and the history of us as a people. And this whole point of view of understanding how we have been exploited. The way they were making the argument of for more money for HBCUs is sort of made me a little weary in terms of, are we willing to accept a means to an end to say if we can get more money, if regardless of not understanding the principles in which we are functioning in, would that truly bring us to our goal of true liberation? Because for me to do that, we must understand that we are too participating in our own form of exploitation when it comes to our youth. So, but that's something to think about. I'd like to hear your thoughts and others. I'll come to you, Brother Alex, your comments and thoughts on that perspective.
Well, first of all, Mr. Robinson, I would like to say thank you for even crossing this subject today, because I'm sure at a lot of HBCUs that they probably don't even want to discuss this, because I'm sure it's made a lot of them ashamed, because a certain word was used and described, and it was called sharecropping. A lot of them took offense with that word. Because through sharecropping, white land owners hoarded the profits of black workers in agricultural labor, trapping them in poverty and debt for generations. Black people who challenged this system of domination faced threat, violence, and even murder. So let's get back to the subject we're talking about. When we're saying that we're going to give you a little something, because that's what they did for playing these major institutions, that we're going to give you a little something, not equal to, not fair as, but we're going to give you a little something for showing up. And as you said, get humiliated on national TV. To force a point down some people's mind that this black college, this HBCU, can't compete with this state-supported school with many millions of federal and state dollars. That's the playing field. That's the true playing field. BCU don't have a locker room, don't have the strength and conditioning coaches, don't have the support staff of an Alabama or an LSU. You are out of your league. Many small schools, Division One, Division Two, and CIAA, the MEAC, SWAC, when they play larger schools, they make sure that they are taking care of their expenses, fly across the country or whatever, hotel stays, meal plans, everything, whole nine yards. And even in the end, after all the bills are paid, they have something left to contribute back to the school. When you're only giving $300,000 or $400,000 or $500,000 That ain't enough money for almost no one to travel with over 100 people on a football team. Maybe a basketball team, but not a football team. It's ridiculous. It is ridiculous that black schools, African-American schools, whatever you want to call yourself, will accept or shortchange to even take the field and show off your band as an asset to your university. You're selling out for national exposure so that you maybe can get someone to come to your school. While the Division I school on the other side doesn't have to beg and cry and get somebody to come there. But our HBCUs are losing attendance. They can't advertise. They can't compete in the same market. But yet and still, the professors, the staff, are great. They've been great for years. That's why most of those schools are still around. Have pride. Have much pride in your school. You may be being humiliated for a few dollars on the field, but you've earned your degree and earned your right to be in the top tier of business in America. But yes, this is a total sellout, a total sellout. But when you do not have the know-how or don't get the people that can make these television deals, then you're in trouble. Because it all comes back to dollars and cents. It all comes back to dollars and cents. You have to know what your product is worth. You got to know how good your product is. You got to know how good your product will sell. African Americans watch a lot of football. Super Bowl parties galore in the African American community. We love football. Look at the amount of players, of black athletes that play football. We love it. It's one of the most inspiring things for a young black youth is to be in the NFL. So we got challenges ahead, as Mr. Sanders said, but we shouldn't be selling out. We shouldn't sell out our product of these good HBCU football teams and be the brunt of jokes and misunderstanding by Division I schools that we're just a bunch of pushovers. Not only on the field, but we're being pushovers. And we should look for more numbers now on those checks. You're worth more. Your product is a good product. But yes, you got to remember, they're out of their league. They're out of their league. But until we can make things fair on both sides, where the HBCUs are getting millions of dollars in their program, then I can see them beating the Michigan State, beating the UCLA, even fighting off Notre Dame. So until that happens, we got to understand that, yes, our colleges are being sharecropped out, as Dion said. And I'd like to turn it over and back to you, Mr. Robinson, and see what the – because I just – this subject is just got me all riled up. I mean, it's just there for me because I love football myself. Love it. And I love going to black football games. Is nothing else like it in the world. Nothing else. But the lead of the numbers that we are accepting on the other side to play these big schools and not thinking that we're not worth more. And I turn it back to you.
Thank you, Ms. Alex. We go to Susie, get her perspective. Susie, in terms of looking at this approach, Are we participating in our own form of exploitation in terms of exploiting our youth at the expense of receiving a few more dollars? Is there more of a greater impact that may not be beneficial to using this particular technique or step to raise money for these HBCUs, universities? What's your perspective, Susie?
Well, the main thing I think is when you look at the HBCUs, you got to look at who's handling the financial situation for each school, and maybe there's some way that we need to get more people that really have a different meaning of what the school really deserves. Apparently, the financial individuals making these decisions and everything, or either they need to go back to school to really find out how to negotiate so these HBCUs can get the amount of money from your advertising, TV, and different things like that. So the problem actually may could be addressed starting with each individual financial officer for that particular school, because I think a lot of them, sometimes you got to think large, and apparently they are thinking on a small scale, and that's why they're not fighting 100% to get these schools the higher amounts. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Susie. And we go on their lines up to our listening audience. You can call in 818-337-0016. As we bring in our next caller again, I want my callers and listeners to be very attentive and listening, because in terms of my nuances or my questions are, one, to open up this relationship between HBCU schools and these super universities with millions of dollars and allow the athletes to play each other on a fairly scale of skills. Are we exploiting our youth and causing more harm than good for the limited amount of money that we are receiving? Is it having an impact on these universities when you play these games? And instead of bringing more recruitment, you're getting less recruitment because of the psychological impact it may be having on others who see, quote unquote, how less competitive these HBCUs are as relates to these big, rich white universities. So is this another form of exploitation of our youth when we're in, brother? Brother, call 6029. Give me your thoughts.
Yeah, well, I think the problem is one of the marketplace. One of the things I think implicit in this conversation is this notion that justice or fairness exists within the context of capitalist marketplace. We have to dismiss any notion that fairness and justice has anything to do with the marketplace. I think also one thing we have to understand, you know, when we talk about, you know, these historical black colleges and universities playing these bigger universities, one thing, there is an implicit bias that does exist among, you know, these larger schools. And one of them is that certainly these smaller African schools don't have the kind of market power, certainly the kind of access to wealth that these larger universities have access to. So we talk about these larger universities with endowments of billions and billions of dollars. Obviously, given the history of this society, small African universities simply can't compete on that level. And the reality is that these larger universities understand that. They also understand that these young men have aspirations to become professional players, most of them. And they realize that visibility is very important for them. In that context, the larger schools can control the access to visibility for these players at these smaller, you know, African universities. And so, therefore, I think it's a bit of a trade-off that's taking place. They're supposed to be adequately compensated, you know, for playing these larger schools. You get some compensation, but not equal compensation, because the larger universities afford the smaller universities the opportunity for their players to be highlighted. So I think that's, again, indicative of the marketplace. So we got to be very, very careful about that. Also, I think one of the things also with this assumption that we make that in fact, that there's a kind of a lack of capability in terms of organizing or articulating, rights with respect to, television rights and advertising and so forth and so on. I think the skills in terms of that are needed in terms of being adequately compensated by smaller African universities is not a real issue per se. I think you do have individuals in the African universities who are well versed in terms of the marketplace, in terms of what it takes in terms of receiving television revenues, contracts and networks and so forth and so on. So I don't think that's the issue. I think perhaps the issue is that the representatives of these historical black universities have brought into the notion, that when you look at in terms of market power, I think they're brought into the notion that African universities simply can't compete with a lot of universities, and as such are willing to accept smaller amounts of money in terms of televised, contest on television. So I think to the extent that when you talk about are the universities exploiting the children, the youth, of course they exploit the youth. Because the thing is that once you buy into this concept in terms of capitalism, once you start thinking in terms of might makes right, that wealth defines all, once you buy into the concept, then you simply play ball. And that is a big, big problem. It seems to me one of the things that African universities have to do is that they have to invest more in terms of outreach to the African communities in terms of resources. I think that's one of the things. I think this class element that exists in African universities, I'm not going to deal with these people simply because they have nothing to offer. I think it's an attitude that's prevalent among a lot of these leaders in these African universities. And as such, they refuse to have any kind of economic outreach when it comes to the African community. Because if you can get the African community to support you by and large, you can certainly compensate for a lot of the shortfalls in terms of the earnings or potential earnings in terms of, these televised football events on television. So I think the historical black universities have to understand the role that the African community play in terms of the system, in terms of financing their program. Because I think the finance is a very important piece. Because one thing Deion Sanders talked about, when he talked about the fact that, that the $400,000 or $500,000 is disseminated throughout the university, clearly, when you think about, when you contrast that to large universities, that money they bring in from football program goes solely to the football program. And so, therefore, it seems to me that if we're going to have a program in African universities where the athletic programs are financially enriched, I think it has to involve the involvement of the African community in terms of outreach, in terms of receiving more funds from African universities. So that's my view on that, and I'll close with that.
Thank you, caller. We'll come back to you later, and we'll go to our next caller, caller 6057. We'd like to have your perspective on the question that was raised around HBCUs and whether or not if this strategy of playing larger, wealthy European universities is a good one in terms of understanding and accepting the idea of being willing to exploit your youth at the expense to gain a few more dollars for that institution. What's your thoughts on that phenomenon, caller 6057?
Okay. Hello. I thank you for letting me participate in the program today. And let's see, my views on it is one of the many lessons that Malcolm X left us with was history is one of the fields that best rewards our research. And a lot of Africans that look at these HBCUs playing, predominantly European institutions do not know the history of how these HBCUs got to that point. A lot of the HBCUs were founded either by government agencies or European missionaries. So they were from the outset, a lot of them imbued with a neocolonialist mentality. That's why a lot of these institutions think so small in terms of the value of their players. Because a lot of the administration of these HBCUs have a neocolonialist mentality. In other words, they'll settle for crumbs from the plantation owner's table, so to speak. And this is very exploitative of our youth that put in the work, to try to be the best they can be on the football field, dealing with, inferior resources that the predominantly white European universities have, and I think it's demeaning, and as a matter of fact, it causes some Africans to look down on the possibility of going to these HBCUs, because not knowing the history of how they developed, they have the perception that HBCUs are inherently inferior to their predominantly European counterparts. So even from a short range standpoint, it hurts recruitment in a sense. But looking at the larger picture, to lose for just a few dollars is unfair to the student athlete, and it's humiliating to the HBCUs and the communities that they're based in.
Thank you, Carlo. We'll come back to you later on. Let's go to our next Carlo and get their thoughts on the subject. Carlo, we're gonna bring you in at 7236. 7236. Your thoughts.
Thank you so much for taking my call and allowing me to participate. I think that it is the exploitation of our youth, the injuries that they sustain, and there's so many things that are problematic. In terms of, as one of the previous speakers said, that universities like Notre Dame and others have these huge endowments. And I think, quite frankly, that the African universities need to have better negotiators and put businessmen at the table that are able to negotiate reasonable terms and conditions for their playing these games, because they're big money makers. I think the notion of taking a little bit because we're suffering so is ridiculous. I think the reality is that, as Sanders said, the coach of the Jackson State University said that it's a failure to have the appropriate people at the table. And one of the things that we really need to do is demand more money, expect more money, with the realization that these larger white schools or larger universities in America have the endowment and have the resources. Also, in terms of streaming and TV rights, that's where real money is also. So there are many, many, many pots that we need to have our hands in, that the HBCUs need to have their hands in when they're playing and negotiating these contracts to play these football games. It's not, and they need to cover their costs. They need to cover their costs. Not having, back in the day when I was at university, they had a huge bus that carried all the students to the games. That's ridiculous. They need to be flown to where they're going. They need reasonable accommodations. And if all they're doing is covering costs, then it's not worth it. And there are injuries associated with football that we all know that these, our children, will have to live with all of their lives. So, yes, this is a form of exploitation, but we are those who can change it by having businessmen that negotiate contracts with TV, with media, and know what they're doing and get the big bucks. And I think it can be done. And, yes, it is a form of exploitation of our youth and of the university itself.
Thank you, Carla. We'll come back to you later. Let's take our next caller. Caller 4298. Caller 4298. Your thoughts. 4298.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lee. First of all, I'd like to thank Brother Alex for this penetrating analysis. Certainly the vanguard of the revolution, the Black Panther Party. We have to recognize their contribution to the struggle. And so I appreciate that. I think on this football situation, I think the correct analysis had to begin as with Brother Anthony, with a dialectical historical materialist approach to the problem by starting out where these historical Black community colleges and university, how they originated and the development and the contradictions there. And so sooner or later, you know, racism is about keeping wealth away from Black people. And so we have to understand that everything grows up within the society in that context. We're faced with a racist institutionalized system, and the games between the historically Black community colleges and Black colleges and universities and the other more endowed universities must be seen in that context as a tiered system. You don't get equal pay for equal work, which would be the legitimate demand. The women's soccer teams, the women's basketball teams, all demanding that. And certainly, if we're all on television, we're all bringing in the audience. I mean, well, how do you? I mean, I understand that you know, in this world system, there's going to be Muhammad Ali's and they're going to be demanding a purse greater than their opponents. And so it's the same with these universities and colleges and stuff. They have powerhouses and if they're winning all the time, they're going to be demanding more money because their audience is supposedly vaster. So we have those kind of contradictions to deal with.
But like I said, racism is about keeping wealth out of the hands of black people. We were brought here as slaves, and we've been worked, and we've never been paid for the work that we're doing. It continues in this context of football as well as other sports. It has its contradictions manifest themselves. Anyway, I'll leave it right there. Thank you.
Thank you, caller 4298. We're going back to Brother Alex, and then we're going back around and suck around to our listeners and participants as we discuss this particular point of issue dealing with the subject matter, and that is, Brother Alex, when we talk about looking at this particular issue, we got to be real careful about, we can't do what your oppressor do and think that we will come out of our situation being successful. That's to say that there's a school of thought in terms of when we look at college athletes today or college athletic departments and the money they raise for the university, that all the money, if that particular sport makes, should go back to that department. And there's another thought that the money that they make, that department makes, should be shared across the school as a whole. Where do you fall at on this issue in terms of the amount of money that's raised by these particular departments or that particular sport? Should it be money allocated for the use of the well-being of the whole school or go back to that department to help generate it? Can we and be successful as a whole? What is your thoughts on that, on those arguments, Brother Alex?
Well, when we look at college funding, because that's what we're really talking about here, is what department gets what. When we look at research grants that go to different universities, $1 million here, $10 million there, $20 million there, $100 million here, and these are research grants. Those grants aren't shared all over the university. So it's not paying the janitorial staff. It's not paying the president's salary. It's going to that area of expertise within the university. So when we look at what the football or the basketball or baseball or whichever one, they have to share that budget to continue with the other programs that do not make money. So if you got to share money with your track program, your baseball program, your golf program, and all these other things that may not attract many spectators or no national attention, you're in trouble. $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 for one big game is not a lot of money. Once you take the expenses out, you're left almost penniless, sometimes in the red. But you accept that for exposure in hopes that you're going to get a few more recruits. You might get a few more people that want to attend your university. But that's not a good reason to sell yourself short. When other schools out here and programs are getting three times as much money, and with failing programs, you may be the CIAA champ, but yet and still you go against Ohio State. They're not going to pay you for so much money. You still may not hit the $1 million mark. Ohio State, before they even put the ink on the line, might ask for $10 million of TV rights because their game's going to be broadcast all over the nation. Not to say that your program is anywhere near that, but you're still telling me that you're not even worth a tenth of what the other team is? If I had to go with those odds on the football field where I felt that I wasn't even worth a tenth of what the other team was, I wouldn't even suit up. I called in sick to tell Coach, ain't playing today. Because You've told me that I'm worthless, that I don't deserve to be out there, because the amount of money that you receive, you sold me out. You sold the university out. You sold every department out. Now, we have to take that little pitiful check of $350,000 or $400,000, and now it's got to go all over the university. That's ridiculous. That's totally ridiculous. Yes, the university deserves some, but it should be negotiated. Okay. Give the football team $500,000. Give the school another $500,000. Half and half. Depending on how great or how good the athletic department is, they need $600,000, give them $600,000. School's having financial trouble, whatever. Then reverse. Give the school $600,000, athletic department take $400,000. Whatever deal that you could make out within the school itself, it's fine. But don't sell yourself out short where there's no money left for the institution. There's barely enough money to cover your expenses. And for too long, we have not learned how to gauge that, how to know our worth. You know, it was mentioned, you know, in one of the conversations about that. You know, black confidence needs to come out at that moment when you're at the bargaining table, because the other team over there has black players on it. Might be a white institution, but it's got predominantly black players. So you're facing the best of the best, maybe, in the school across the field, but they're black, just like you. Both sides is being sold out to play that game. Because who's making the real big dog is not on the field. They sitting in the boardroom smoking cigars, selling those television ads, those rights, TV rights to all these different stations and stuff. That's where the true money is. But you, as a university or college, African American, are accepting less when you ought to be getting more. And so that's the biggest thing that we have to look at. Share the money. I don't have a problem with it. It should be shared with the university. But have some money to share. Negotiate a deal where you can take care of some of your school's other enterprises. That's what the other schools do, a lot of them. It not only just goes to the football department alone, but, yeah, they do share some money with some of the other departments. But you can't have nothing to share if you didn't get nothing. And that's my biggest problem with it, is that the schools are taking too less money to do anything with. They need to raise the stakes. The money is there. There's no question that the money is not there. The money is there. But you have to go forward and be united at these HBCUs, the whole conference. You got to get together and demand more for your product and stop being sellouts. That's our biggest problem, is we're selling out just to get a few dollars to keep our programs going when we should be asking for millions. It's ridiculous. You answering for hundreds of thousands of dollars. Who even could imagine that? I never believed that these schools were just getting hundreds of thousands of dollars. Never did. When I know that the school on the other side is getting millions of dollars for the same game. And it has black players. Black players on both sides of the field. I just don't understand it. But we represent it there as a worker, because that's what old football players are. They're working, so they're the workers. So by them being the workers, don't nobody see their work. They only see them as workers. And the ones who brought them there to work, as far as the African-American colleges They see them as a lesser, much lesser threat in coming to them to asking them for more money and what they deserve. And so we bow our heads and accept what they give us. But they should be demanding more. And there's also another wonderful article on this subject. And, you know, it'll be worth looking at from Anscape. Big paycheck or big headache. HBCUs rethink playing the money games. And that's what you got to do. You got to rethink playing these money games. And you got to have a plan to go to the table and demand more money. And I turn it back over to you, Mr. Robinson.
Thank you, Brother Alex. You sort of put in mind of the idea of another example in which we get played while they truly get paid. So thank you for your comment. We're going to go to caller 6029. Come back to caller 6029 and raise the question with the caller about the philosophy. Is it a subtle philosophy where the department head or the sports department for that university should get all of the money that it produced in the area of sports, or should that money be divided among the whole university? Brother, caller 6029, where do you fit in terms of one or the other? Because my earlier question was that I don't think HBCU could really use the same method that the rich white universities use where all the money goes to their sports department, because it don't have the same structure, means, and history. But anyway, what's your thoughts on that, Carlo?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the bottom line is that when we think about the historical mission of HBCUs, it's to educate the community. In that regard, athletics may play an important part in terms of the operation of the university, but it necessarily encompasses the entire philosophy of the organization. After all, the priority in terms of the universities is to educate, and so that is where we got to keep that in mind. I think in terms of sharing of the wealth, I think one of the things that clearly you're right, when you talk about the larger universities with endowments of billions of dollars, they're in a position where they can actually use those revenues solely for the athletic department. Well, in terms of the historical black college universities, it's a different paradigm. I mean, the reality is that, let's keep in mind that when we talk about, you know, the financing of African universities, largely comes from the government itself. In the sense that we talk about in terms of, government financing students in terms of being able to pay the bill to attend these universities. And so in that context, of course, the African universities are working at somewhat of a deficit to start with. And so therefore, so if we're truly committed to the idea in terms of the priority in terms of educating the people, I certainly can understand why those resources that are coming in from the athletic program will be disseminated, at least partially, to the overall functioning of the university. Necessarily understandable. But I think the larger question is, I think that, you know, one of the things, and I keep returning to, is that we have to understand, you know, the reality is in terms of, because we understand the structural limitations in terms of, you know, the operating of these African universities, because we understand that, then it seems to me that the only alternative for African universities is to seek resources outside, you know, of the established perimeters for college financing. And in that context, I think it's important for historical black college universities to look outside the U.S. for funding in terms of fulfilling its mission. I think for whatever reason, African universities have been hesitant to look outside of the U.S. in terms of funding, you know, to achieve, you know, its mission. So I think historically black and college HBCUs, I think they have to start looking different ways in terms of bringing in money into the universities. But in doing it, I'm very aware of the fact that they're very much concerned that if they if they're if they're their methods in terms of raising funds become too controversial, they're afraid that the government will cut them off in terms of allowing, you know, have accessing, you know, loans for students to attend the universities. So I noticed to some extent they're caught between a rock and a hard place, and I don't want to belittle that because it's important we understand that if you go, in order to fulfill your mission, you've got to have some money as opposed to no money at all. So I do understand the kind of paradox of African universities are confronted with in terms of financing. But having said that, I think it's important to understand that, you know, that, you know, we have to take that chance in terms of, you know, seeking alternate means in terms of financial support for these universities. Because if we really think in the context of capitalism that somehow that this question of equity and fairness is going to play a part in terms of negotiation of these TV contracts or these media contracts, if we really think that that is going to be the defining fundamental aspect, you know, of providing money for historical black universities, then we delude ourselves into believing something that certainly can't happen and won't happen. Not just from historical standpoint, as the brother alluded to, in terms of, you know, the legacy of black universities as relates to, you know, who actually started black universities, but also from an economic standpoint, when we start thinking about the fact that, you know, in the context of capitalism, clearly there is an assumption made that some schools are better than others. And a lot of the assumption is made that some schools are better than others, then certainly in terms of financing those universities or making the possibility to finance universities, there's going to be a schism between, you know, those universities that are perceived as, quote, educationally sound versus those universities that are perceived as somehow lacking educationally. So as long as we have that difference in terms of perception around education, then we have to understand fundamentally that those African universities are at a very difficult situation. And because they're at a very difficult situation, they have to make some very tough choices. But I don't think for the large part, these are leaders in these African universities are ready to make these tough decisions because out of fear that it might undermine their financial interest in the long term. And I close with that.
Thank you, caller. We'll come back to you later. We'll go to our next caller, 6057. Your thoughts on this philosophy of should all the money stay in the athletic department where the sports generate the money, or should that money be divided among the whole universities? Can African universities play that game? Call us 6057. Where do you fall at?
I think the money should go to the entire university, because it is the resources of the university that come into play when these football teams or whatever money making sport at the school is have to go up against these predominantly European universities. So, you know, as Brother Alex stated earlier, I think HBUs settle for too little when they negotiate these contracts. And, you know, and because of historical limitations, not to mention cultural ones as well, we can't play the exact play the game the same way the European counterparts do, and so I think the resources generated should be shared with the entire university. I think one of the big contradictions is that HBUs settle for way too little, and in order to overcome that hurdle, they may have to get better organized themselves in order to demand greater resources for their labor.
Thank you, Carla. Let's go to Carla 7236 and get her thoughts on this issue. Carla 7236. does all the money stay in the department or should we share among the university as a whole? 7236. Okay, while we wait for caller 7236 to respond, let's try caller 4298. Caller 4.
Hello? Oh.
Yes, yes, caller. Your response.
Yes, I think that there should be a budget, and that budget doesn't start at the end. It starts in the beginning, meaning that when you're negotiating these contracts, you need to have the bottom line of what the expense to the football team, to the band, to the coaches, to cheerleaders, everyone involved, and that a great portion of that money needs to go, obviously, to the football team. It's such a dangerous sport, and so they need to have proper trainers and the medical staff to support them, because after all, these are children. These are our youngsters that are playing at these universities, and they have their whole life ahead of them. And they need, if they made the commitment to play football, some of them are probably there on football scholarships, that the university owes them something, and that's that they not only get a quality education, but they come out without lifelong injuries. So money is needed to prevent that. So I think a good portion of the money should go to the football team, and that the HBCUs are going to we need to build their endowments. But to answer your question briefly, yes, I think not all of the money, but a good portion of the money should definitely go to the team and the band.
Thank you, caller. Let's go to 4298. Your thoughts, caller 4298.
Yeah, I mean, everything sounds reasonable, Lambie, but I don't have a hands-on approach to this. I like to get down to the facts and figures and what it's costing to play these games and what revenues are coming in, et cetera. And I don't have those kind of facts, so I don't feel qualified to even say which one, whether it should go to the department. I understand that the historically black community colleges and universities, because of the way they develop, that they have a need for money, and it's a greater need than those other schools evidently. And so I understand the thrust towards wanting to get whatever revenues come in to have a portion of it. But again, I don't have the figures, the actual budgets and stuff for these universities and colleges and what the television stations are able to do, and et cetera, et cetera. I just don't feel qualified. Thank you.
Thank you, Carla. You know, as we talk about this subject, the more you talk about it and look at it and critique it, it definitely make you think about its relationship to the institution of slavery. It holds many facets that exist in the institution. And you can see it through this arena, this arena through sports, when the confines of this captive system. For example, I'm just wondering, and we start out with Brother Alex again. I would like to in general get his thoughts on when we talk about value our young people's lives and stuff as athletes. How do you function or create scenarios and situations where you have a football team composed of maybe a minimum of 56 to 72 football players? Each weekend they go out and play the sport, but they play the sports under a condition where you have no medical trainers or assistants available in case someone gets hurt. How do you allow that situation to exist if you are a president, if you are a commission, or any kind of league? I don't understand that. Maybe, Alex, you can make some sense of that. To have that kind of operation, you'll have a basic trainer. We're not talking about one trainer at the minimum, which we know is not that many. You need more. But there are situations that has been reported. You got both football teams with no medical staff at all while the young children are playing this violent game. How do you be a president? How do you be a department head? How do you be a commissioner in the league and allow children to function under those kind of conditions? Brother Alex.
Well, Mr. Robinson, we first got to try, and I mean try to understand. You know, we got to go back and really look, take a deep look at our history of being mistreated in this country, because that's where it all starts from. Not only to say that there are not enough trainers or not even one trainer at any college university. I remember trainers when we had segregated schools in high school. I mean, it's out of my mind to even think that any university from 1970 forward, any HBCU would not have adequate trainers, strength and conditioning coaches, nutritionists, team physicians that call you off the field when you get a concussion. There are so many things that a football team needs, and these things should be determined by conference leadership. You shouldn't be able to play a game if you ain't got adequate medical staff to handle the injuries that may happen. I've even heard cases where there may not even have been insurance by the other college that was playing, that if a player got hurt and his career ended that day, that they didn't even have insurance money to cover that child. So first thing as a parent that I would be considering when I chose whether it's an HBCU or any independent school, private or public college, to investigate what happens when my child gets hurt and his future is over. He can't play anymore. There are so many things wrong, and it started out wrong a long time ago with African-American universities. We wanted to play the sport. We wanted to showcase our talents because that was the only place and only place that you could go to in the 50s and 60s to show your talent. So once we got into the 70s and these schools did get more money, why was not the focus also on making sure that these young people stayed healthy? Yes, the main purpose of you going to college is for an education. Schools recruit you because they don't know whether you're going to be there 4 years or not. You might only be there 1 year and leave. That's why they had to put regulations in to try and keep them 2 or 3 years. So in doing so, everybody needs to be protected. The school needs to be protected from you just using them as a springboard to the NFL. And the school needs to be protected if anything happens to you, because that's a huge lawsuit against them. So we have to be careful in saying what we truly want by these boards that start making decisions on our children. And I say it again as a parent, on our children's decision. Because a lot of these kids are under 21. And for me, they may rear up and tell you that they grown at 18, 19, or 20. But until they 21 and out my house, then they grown. You can do what you want. You got your own place. I'm not footing your bills anymore. Then you grown. But until that point in time, I'm still a parent, and I'm thinking of your best interest at heart. So that means that anything that happens to you out on that football field, as far as concussions are concerned, and we know today how deadly concussions are. Athletes get hurt in the seventh, eighth, ninth grade, broken bones, dislocation, sprains. You get hurt. You continue to get hurt. It's multiplying in college. You don't get the surgeries you need to repair ligaments and stuff. You're in trouble. Then you get an ill-equipped trainer or no trainer at all. No one with your best interest at heart. A coach has to manage 60 players almost. There's no way he can continue to focus down the line on every player he has. How many kids going to say, "Coach, I'm hurting. I can't play today." No, they want that exposure because they're trying to get to the next level and trying to keep the scholarship to continue playing. We cannot trust our children's word on how well they are before they go out there on that field. And now we put them at risk and in danger with no trainer, no medical personnel, but the EMS that may be sitting there and maybe not, because I've went to college football games and did not see an EMS present. There was no medical personnel sitting out there. They had to call them. I'll be going to a football game next weekend, and I pray that they have trainers and medical staff there to take care of whoever get injured. Like I say, I love football, but I think it's only fair when everything is thought of. Take care of the players, because they're the ones that's out there in the trenches, as we say. We're sitting in the stands, yepping and hollering, swaying with the band. But the kids out there on the field, they're getting hurt. And they're not even telling us how serious that those injuries are. We only know about maybe half of what they're going to report, because they don't want not to be out there next week because someone else may take their place. So they're fighting to stay on that field week to week. But we as parents have to be more attentive to what's going on any football team. Don't leave it to the coaches. Your parent, talk to your child, find out what's going on. That's where the true training comes from. From the parent. And I turn it back over to you, Mr. Robinson.
Thank you, Yadis. Caller 6029. When we talk about fiduciary responsibilities from presidents to department heads to commissioners or these historical black colleges, is there any situation that can justify putting a team out there on the field where you don't have one person who has legal know-how and authority or know how to take care of an injured player who might get hurt? How do you justify playing a game where you have no one available to deal with any kind of possible injury? Isn't that a crime within itself? Call us 6029. Your thoughts.
Well, if you're gonna give it the context of fiduciary responsibility, of course, you can always be justified to cut costs in order to sustain the mission, you know, of the university. So clearly, if you're gonna put it in capitalist terms, they don't have a problem philosophically in terms of doing that, simply because, you know, listen, they have salaries they have to provide. They have the internal workings of the university, the heat, the maintenance, all those kind of things that are needed for the university. Those things can't take precedent over the injury of football players. But more, but philosophically speaking, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's incomprehensible that you would have a narrative where you actually have people playing a very violent game like football, and you don't have the necessary medical people that you need, on the sideline. But my guess is that, given that reality, I think to some extent you will have somebody vaguely familiar with medical procedure on the sideline. I don't think it's totally a situation where people are totally void of any kind of medical knowledge at all on the sideline. I think you can have some people who may be unqualified in terms of administering medical care, but who have a superficial understanding in terms of medical care who are on the sideline. That is my guess. But I think just in terms of fiduciary responsibility, I'm not surprised at all, because the bottom line is that, listen, the mission of the university, if it's in fact to educate the community, it has to take precedent on all other things. So I'm not surprised at all that you have a situation where, you have people, you don't have qualified people on the sideline to administer care when these football players get injured. So I'm not surprised at all. I close with that.
Thank you, caller. Let's go to caller and get his response. Caller 6057. Your response, 6057.
I think there should be adequate medical personnel available for the players because, the players are human beings and is subject to getting hurt, as Brother Alex stated earlier. And that is on the parents to make sure that there is a way to address a situation in which players get hurt. Hopefully that doesn't happen, but it can. And it's on the parent to monitor to make sure that the program, that the athletic program is adequately equipped to address that situation. Again, it's not so much on the youth because they don't know they don't know any better. And at this stage in their life, they just want to play as many games as possible and in order to advance their career. But the thing about it, though, one who is playing the role of the parent, they have to think of those things. And what happens if the worst eventuality happens and someone gets hurt? And so I think that's something that people have to be aware of. And that there should be adequate resources to address that. Shouldn't be left to chance.
Thank you, caller. We'll come back to you, and we'll go to our next caller, 7236. Your response, caller, 7236.
Yes. Again, I would say this is where budgeting comes in, and negotiating the contract with the parties involved so that the team will be able to have adequate medical personnel traveling with them. I think it's too big a responsibility even to put on the parents. It really is. It would take a course for the parents, if not more than one, for them to develop the skills to know what the anatomical impact of the sport could be and of certain injuries. So I feel that definitely the team should be working with and have a regular medical professional that follows the team. It could very well be the doctor that is the chief medical officer of the university that also follows the team. Thank you.
Thank you, Carla. Thank you, Carla. What I want to do is when we look at this situation, and we're talking about being sharecroppers, maybe we can move from that particular status if you apply some basic business techniques, understanding that all sustainable institutions do in terms of trying to organize for longevity. That is to say, for most HBCUs and African institutions, where's the issue or the thrust in terms of creating endowments or creating trust accounts, where you create large sums of money for a long period of time that will ensure the viability of that institution? Why is that not endowments created and being funded independently by these various institutions, particularly given the fact that when you're talking about being in existence 100, 150, 200 years, and you have had alumni graduate and went on to make a profitable career, whatever. But the whole point of understanding the need for endowments, creating trust, different kind of ways how you can raise money and build up capital to make sure the institution function overall. Why isn't that more emphasis put on those kind of tools being created in these HBCUs, universities? Start with you, Brother Alex, your response.
Well, Mr. Robinson, we have to look at, again, as the gentleman first mentioned, these HBCUs were created through the Freedmen's Bureau, most of them, and a lot of them through church affiliations. And some of them were privately funded, you know, from African Americans, you know, themselves, who got together and started that university. When you're given something, then sometimes you don't cherish it. And we take a gift sometimes and put it anywhere. We misplace it. We forget about it. It was a gift. But when you earn something, if you have to work hard to bring it about, then there's more care and responsibility for it. There is no way, and I'll give you an example of St. Paul's there in Virginia. Good school, 1888, was founded. Very good school. Football team, basketball team, quite a few others. But she reached a point where finances became a huge issue. And from 1888, to 21st century, you're going to tell me that over 100 years of existence, that this school falls out of favor with the state as well as the federal government, is not continually supported. Regardless of the reason, mismanagement of money or whatever has happened with a lot of schools, staff leaving, professors quitting for higher jobs, you know, somewhere else or whatever, poor chancellors, whatever the reasons, the alumni, for some reason, did not come together and search out that trust and endowment funds many years ago to save a university that had been around for a long time. This is just one school of many which have closed because of different problems over financing. $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $700,000, $1 million is not going to save any university. It may help in the budget crisis, but it's not going to save them. What's going to save them is just what you said. Endowments, trust, research grants, striking out to charities and different things. You do the same thing that the people across the aisle do to raise money, to bring in funding. They can talk to one another regardless. Schools came about almost the same way yours did. Federal funded, church affiliations, and people getting together to start them. So it's the same structure, except for how they feel about the gift they were given and the gift we were given. Their gift, they hold it up on a pedestal, University of Texas, USC. They hold that on Ohio State. They hold it on a pedestal. Penn State is up on a pedestal. And they rub your face in it every day on how great their universities are. But for over 100 years, HBCUs have graduated some of the most talented and brilliant people that ever came out of college. To continue that, yes, you need endowment funding. You need to set up trust, find grants for the university and stuff. Everything should be just so together on finding finances to keep African-American colleges solvent. We should have and research for the best people out there to organize and bring about monies to these conferences. It's just ridiculous when we read MEAC, CIAA, all these different boards. And then they go and meet with Congress. They meet with presidents. And they walk away with almost nothing every time. All it takes is for a Duke University to ask Congress for a few billions of dollars. And they signed a check. No questions asked. Whatever the reason, and even if you ain't got a reason, we'll find one for you. We want to make sure that Duke's in the spotlight. But why can't the same thing be done for schools that you appropriated hundreds of years ago to say that they will be the stellar achievement of African Americans? That you want to finally bring some stability from the slaves that you held in bondage for so many years and give them an opportunity to rise above poverty, to do for themselves. The Freedmen's Bureau was to make sure that we began on a road to financial success, and college was one of those steps. We have forgot. All of us have forgot how important it is to remind ourselves to make sure that our children are educated. I don't see the parents coming into schools like I used to, worried about their kids' college education. I went to a PTA meeting this year, and I didn't see one African-American parent on college night. I couldn't believe it. Not one. Years ago, there were over 200, 300, 400 that came and were concerned about their kids getting into college. And at least 50% of them were inquiring about African-American colleges. But now that interest is not there. It's not there anymore in my community. Maybe different in other communities. But in my community, it is slacked off. and the parents could care less. If they get in it, they get in it on their own. They're not getting in it with parental help. So we got to start supporting BCUs ourselves, the alumni associations and everything. We got to show how important that this part of America still is, because this is the part of America that supported black business for a long time, black lawyers. We got a Supreme Court justice, one of the best ever, Thurgood Marshall. We have to realize the greatness of black colleges. And I turn it over to back to you, Mr. Lee.
Thank you, Alex. Brother caller 6029, your thoughts on the lack of emphasis and why is it after 150 years later HBCUs have not established their own endowment, create trust, etc., to ensure the longevity of the institution? Your response.
Brother, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that HBCUs consciously is making an effort not to invest in endowments. I don't think that's the situation. I think the bottom line is that when you talk about endowments, you got to talk about the politics involved in terms of endowments. Certainly one of the things is that, you know, when you talk about these investments, you know, often, you know, under the table, you know, decisions are made with respect to endorsement. Not only are they made under the table, but they also ensure a certain amount of success in terms of investment in these kind of instruments. So I think in that context, when you talk about in terms of having access to the best instruments in terms of returns, I'm not necessarily sure that that the people in positions of power in terms of the, you know, shaping, you know, endowments, particularly interest in terms of the empowerment of African universities. So I think that's something we might want to consider in terms of why, you know, these historic African universities are not, you know, boiling over, you know, with endowments. I think also I think that to the extent that African universities invest in endowments, I think it's negated by, you know, the rising costs, overall costs in terms of society. I think, you know, as the cost of inflation continues to spiral out of control, it's having a devastating impact on institutions, not just universities, but institutions generally. And so I think in that context, when we think about it in terms of the inflationary impact on college institutions, I think clearly when you talk about, when you contrast, say, these large universities with smaller African universities, then certainly the potential in terms of negative impact as inflation grows weighs much more heavily on these African universities than does these large universities. So when we talk about, see, keep in mind when we talk about these larger universities, not only are we talking about, you know, a much longer period of time in terms of investments. I do understand your point in terms of, you know, it's been 150 years, while some of these African universities are not more endowed in terms of, you know, their, in terms of, you know, savings, given the fact that they've been around for 150 years. But to keep in mind, because they've even existed 150 years. Doesn't mean that the opportunity in terms of accruing or making money existed 150 years. Keep that in mind. So for a lot of these historical black universities, the opportunity in terms of investments is a relatively new phenomenon. It's not something that's been existed over 150 years for these black universities. But keep in mind, most black universities were privately funded, you know, by wealthy white folks. It wasn't a situation where, you know, people, you know, consciously created a process in terms of endowment for these black universities to ensure their survival. It was only temporary measures. They weren't designed to last a long time. And so this is, so in other words, they served a political purpose. In other words, you create a university to teach people what you want them to know and nothing more. It wasn't designed in terms of a long-term project. And so this is the thing we have to fundamentally understand in terms of when we talk about these endowments. And now if you look at currently in terms of endowments, I mean, if you go back and you look at the, you know, the historical black universities' investments, I mean, they're investing certainly more in terms of trying to, you know, bring about, you know, some positive returns when it comes to, you know, creating these endowments. But the problem is that, you know, like I said, it's politics. It's behind the scenes. It's the things that we don't normally talk about, things that we don't quite understand exist. in terms of the kind of machinations that exist in terms of, the politics behind, these endowments and a lot of things, a lot of chicanery in which we're totally unaware of that takes place behind the scene, which necessitates, a certain low returns for African universities as opposed to these large universities. So I don't think that these African universities, by and large, are negating the importance in terms of, expanding these endowments. I think there is a push to do that. But I think the bottom line is that if we talk in the context of capitalism, then we understand the chicanery, the trickery behind it, the deception they employ to make it look like the stock market is somehow a fair institution. Your bottom line is anything but fair. It's very manipulated. It's very rigged. And unfortunately, it doesn't always bode well, for African universities in their pursuit of endowments. And I'll close with that.
Thank you, Carla. Let's hear the response from Carla 6057. 6057?
Yes. I would add to the points the previous caller made by adding that that the alumni of HBCUs didn't always do as well financially as their European counterparts from these predominantly European universities. For example, very few alumni from HBCUs became managers, congressmen, or senators as a result of getting a degree from HBCUs. As a matter of fact, even though some were very successful, a lot were either unemployed, severely underemployed in some cases. For example, whereas someone coming from a predominantly European institution with, say, a master's degree could get a job in their field that was commensurate with their degree, their African counterparts from HBCUs were severely underemployed. They had to get a job at a post office or in primary or secondary education. So in addition to the factors that were brought out earlier, I think the alumni of HBCUs had much resources to work with overall for creating endowments or trusts than their European counterparts at European institutions like a Harvard, Yale, or Princeton, or Georgetown.
Thank you, Carla. And we go to Carla 7236, your response, 7236.
I agree with the two previous callers in reference to endowment. However, alumni endowment. However, when you look at HBCUs and you look at other universities, there's a lack of investment by the state, by the federal government, as well as corporate commitments. Look at Howard University. Dr. Charles Drew was there. He invented gave us blood plasma banks, but he wasn't doing it under a research grant. He was carrying his work under the weight of his work was paid for by the university, and that was it. So you see underfunding of HBUs, and it is racism, systemic racism, because we've seen many in recent years, many business schools and these little pop-up institutions are now accredited by Mid-Atlantic, just like Princeton or Yale, while HBCUs, as Alex said, that have been around for 134 or more years are going out of business. This is not an alumni funding problem. This is systemic racism and a failure by the state, federal government, and corporate investment into these institutions. And it is, in effect, disenfranchising the black community and undermining the future of our youth.
Thank you, Carla. And we'll go back to Brother Alex. And what I would do right now to our listeners and participants, I raise one more fundamental question, and then we'll ask each one of y'all, give y'all final thoughts on how do we get out of this environment of HBCUs being football sharecroppers. This is my final question in terms of this your discussion for today, and that is, when you look at HBCUs, historically it was created, it came into existence, and functioned at the beginning and presently as a neo-colonial tool of oppression. Not saying it doesn't have positive elements that we can use, but I think fundamentally, if one look at it, it's put in existence to uphold and serve the interests of the elite and the capitalist system. And we can see this by some of its behavior. For example, if HBCUs want to run at the money and get the money and be exploited at the expense of the white dominant universities, one of the criteria to do that, or one of the causes or results for doing that, is that there seem to be tendencies to help destroy your own division or your own, network of independent African schools. For example, many HBCU schools, they had their own conferences. And for them to strive to get more money or go for more money, they changed their status from these so-called their own independent conferences to become Division I schools. As a consequence of becoming Division I schools, you weaken your historical conferences, and then you make it become more difficult for those schools that remain in those conferences to survive. That's something that they have put in place as a cause or consequence for HBCUs who want to run for the money. So long run, it seems to be destroying our own independent institutions, the ones valuable and was striving. Number two, how do they make us believe psychologically that they are more superior than we are, when we alluded to earlier that they take your children, our children, out of the community and bring it to their institutions to play against their own community, but yet can tell you are inferior. So how do we deal with those realities and get out that mindset, Brother Alex? Your response to the statements that just made.
Well, Mr. Robinson, we have to look at it again. We can go back hundreds of years, and it all comes to be the same. Separate, divide, and conquer. Separate. That means to put people that were together like a family. The slaves came over, husband and wife, sisters and brothers, grandparents, separate and sell off. Once you destroy the bond of family, it's easy to attack anybody when they don't believe that they have no one to support them. Once that separation is made, then I can begin to institutionalize you into whatever I want you to do. Because, see, that's the mainstream of what I want to now teach you, since you have no mentorship. You have no history. You have no culture. You have no God to worship. You have nothing. So that makes you dependent on me. That's what the slaves here were taught, to be dependent on their European masters. Dependent so that when I give you schools through Christian affiliation, through government affiliation, that you understand still that you are inferior to me. Because they're not going to teach you everything that the higher state schools or private universities like Harvard, Yale, and Columbia, you're not going to have the same books. You're not going to have the same professors. You're not going to have the same teachers. So I'm going to give you something that's going to teach you vocational skills, how to serve me. Not where you can build your own and start your own. Not where you can learn about how stocks and bonds are traded, how to build trust and endowments and different things to support yourself like I am. But I want you to learn how to make more inventions, to build things, to make things, so that you can make my economy even greater. Then we have to truly look at that financial end of the schools, because being smaller means that you get a smaller portion of the pie. So that means if your enrollment is only 28,000 compared to a state school of 28,000, there's a big difference. So I can pretty much say that I will not give you the same amount of money as I will give the 28,000. So we are looked upon, or African Americans are looked upon still, and have always been looked upon, as second class citizens. That they don't feel that you deserve the best, but just enough to keep you going, to keep you going to college, to keep you going to work every day, to keep you serving a master you have served for over 400 years, and to make you forget that you're still in mental and financial bondage. Our hands are tied between the utilities, the rent, the mortgage, the insurance, credit card. Our hands are tied because minimum wage has not been risen in this country for so long. The rich keep getting richer. As they keep getting richer, they still support the ideas of slavery. They haven't went anywhere. They've just been put on the back burner, hid, not out of sight. But every once in a while, they've been glanced over the shoulder at, and to see how they can continue to disenfranchise you through gerrymandering and everything else. Because all this comes back to how much money you should get, even with the census count, when they count people. Those are your tax dollars being determined. How many African Americans are in this state? How many in that state? How many in this state? Oh, the African Americans is not that many anymore. Now you got another minority group that's higher. Pretty soon you may have another group that's higher. So you constantly begin to fall back in their view in a positive light. When we are separated and cannot get together like these college presidents need to do to reestablish their conference integrity, because, yes, they've been stolen away. North Carolina Central, A&T, different ones have been taken away and been moved to other conferences to weaken the CIAA, the MEAC. When you do that, you take away more dollars from the ones at the bottom, and you move more dollars to the ones at the top. And there's not a big hearsay about it because everybody wants to go to Division I. I don't think too many schools want to be less, but a lot of them want to be that Division I and have that title and move on and to say how much greater we are than the other ones below us. But see, you bring the ones below us with you. Don't leave them behind and forget about them. That's where you got your start. You were just like they were. You were in the same pit that they were in 1920, 1930, 40, 50, 60. You were thought of just as less as they were. But now, because they got a better product, they got to be a bigger school, they take in a larger student enrollment, that we can prey on you and take your best. See, they don't go after poorest performing schools. They got to go after our best schools and try and rob them. And we allow this to happen because we're looking at moving forward, as we say. We're looking at progress. These are things that happen over time. And I heard on one show, I'll never forget that, on the Fox Network, that eventually it may be a thing that they stop funding HBCUs and let them go by the wayside because they teach African-American history. And they don't want to learn it. They don't want to know nothing about it. Our sports are so important because it was where the athletes made their contributions and were thrust into the limelight. And European Americans cheered them, made heroes out of them. But yet and still, the average African American, they put under their knee like George Floyd, care nothing about you at all. They pick and choose in who they want to succeed. They pick and choose on which HBCUs they want to succeed. So we have to be careful in the game that's being played on us because we are being robbed of our black confidence in each other. And we have not supported each other. When I go to a game and see the stands empty, it hurts. I used to go to black college games, Morgan State. You couldn't find a seat in the house, a place to sit almost. The team wasn't the best team either. But yet and still, playing Bowie or whoever, it was barely a seat in the house. Now you can go to football games and well over half the stadium is empty. It is a shame that when I used to go to games and people came out and supported, the community supported these teams, African, because that's all we had. So they supported them, just like they did the Negro Leagues. They came out and they supported them. But once the best is taken away and you're left with whatever you got, if product isn't as good, fans stay away. And then you eventually run into bankruptcy. So we have to be careful. And remember, we got to support our HBCUs. But we also have to hold these conference presidents accountable in the deals that they make for television rights and everything else, because exposure means so much today in everything that we do. When you sell the hats, the T-shirts, the stadium blankets, whatever, there's so much that you can do to be supportive of your school. I got hundreds of hats myself. I don't know how many hats of Carolina, probably about 200 hats of UNC Chapel Hill. But I don't even think I got 10 hats of HBCUs. And just that just gives you a thought that my own support for my own schools, that I don't hold it as in high esteem as I do that UNC Chapel Hill hat. So I have to look back myself and say that, you know, I need to give more. I need to go to more of my own community's games to support my own community. And that's where it all starts at. We have to get back together from being separated. We were separated as slaves, but as the great, great, great grandchildren of slaves, we need to get back together and start acting like the kings and queens we were. And I turn it back to you.
Thank you, Alice. 6029, your thoughts on this question of moving to another division, weaken the division that you come from, and put more pressure on other HBCU schools of being able to be self-sufficient. I mean, the whole idea seems like the more we chase the goal, the more we become unfold as a people. You know, we have our athletes that come from our community, go to their community, and then they turn around and tell you, you're not as good as they are. How do we get past this debacle, caller? 6029, yeah. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, you know, let's be very candid. We're talking about essentially the pursuit of status. And it is a problem, particularly when you talk about, you know, being at war with a system that's diametrically opposed to survival. This whole question in terms of status has to be put in proper context. To the extent achieving status affords you more visibility, but in the larger picture, what you do is not, as you alluded to, is that not only do you weaken, you know, HBCUs in terms of their football program, but you also legitimize this notion that that says bigger universities are better than the smaller universities. In other words, the right universities are superior to the black universities. So clearly, that's something that, you know, we have to think of. I think one of the real ironies is that we're not conditioned to think in those terms. We don't see ourselves necessarily at war. So our pursuit of status is one of recognizing, you know, that at least in our minds that the society is just and fair, and so therefore the rules are fair, or the rules are certainly favorable, and so therefore what we do, it has no real repercussions. Of course, you don't understand the absurdity of that position, but nonetheless, our people tend to think, you know, the rules, in fact, are fair and just. And so, therefore, participating in your own oppression is not seen as participating in your own oppression. It's perceived as moving on up, as George Jefferson would say. So clearly, that's a psychological issue. And the question is that unless we create the institutions and conditions to confront that mindset is going to continue to proliferate. And you're absolutely correct. It does have a deleterious impact on the functioning of other historical black colleges and universities in terms of their visibility for those universities. But because we're not thinking in terms of the collective, since we're thinking only of the individual, we don't care about the implications for those other HBCU universities. You know, when one university decides I'm going NCAA one, we don't think about in terms of implications for other universities because we're conditioned to think those terms. And keep in mind, the people who run those black universities are not preoccupied with the question in terms of empowerment for the African community. What they're preoccupied with is getting a check status that comes with that. Because keep in mind, the potential in terms of, you know, better paying opportunities exists in those large white universities. So one of the things these leaders in these black universities don't want to do is to alienate those potential white employers out there who can pay them a better salary at their university, even to the point where potentially they could become the head of the university. So clearly, it's a real problem. But you know, the bottom line is that unless we have institutions and organizations to confront that mindset, the bottom line is not going anywhere. And this is a problem that we're confronting in the society. So I think to the extent that we can, you know, that we can negate that mindset, then we can truly begin to understand that in order for us to thrive as a people, then we have to understand that the interests of all our people have to be represented and such, that we have to understand that what we do does have an impact on others. And until we get to that realization and we keep on fighting this battle individually, thinking that somehow, you know, we're going to succeed individually, when reality is that in the context of America and a capitalist society, it's all about group power. If you don't see yourself as a group, if you see yourself as an individual, then you simply get slaughtered. It's that simple. And I close with that.
Thank you, Carlo. And we'll go to Carlo 7236. 7236.
Yes, I agree with the last speaker in that we have to build unity and a coalition amongst the HBCUs. It should be a federation or a coalition so that they're abreast of what's going on. And I think funding, federal funding as well as state funding, should be given to them as block grants. And in certain areas, whether it's IT or chemistry or engineering, I see that as a vital tool. And unity is clearly the answer. And when you look at local HBCUs, you look at Bowie State, it has one of the Bowie has one of the best nursing programs in the country, and it's the HBCU. So the bad reputation that these institutions have is just the stigma of being affiliated with the former slaves and African Americans. And right now, the attrition rate for African Americans in predominantly white schools has increased because of the changing society and the diversity of African Americans often are even more of an enigma than they were previously. And the conditions that existed 40 years ago no longer exist. This is a much more diverse America. There are many more ethnic groups and nationalities and language minorities that have their demands. And we ourselves have to unite and recognize ourselves as a group that should have autonomy based on our historic relationship to this country. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carlo. And one final thought. We could talk forever. There are so many contradictions around the subject matter. I would like to raise this one in terms of this question of getting away from being sharecroppers, because after all, this ain't our land. Maybe we need to look at how does Africa fit into this equation? How does the unification of African University here integrating back with Mother Africa and their very institutions? And we do what we have always done, create, develop, compete, and control allies from a position of strength. Once we can control the resource territories back home, we would no longer be in a position of being sharecroppers. Brother Ellis, your response to that narrative, the importance of Africa in this equation.
I think that's a huge a huge thing that all African Americans should consider and think about, because that is our true heritage. That is where we truly began or came from a perilous journey in slavery and bondage. We are people who met a struggle like no other on earth, who came from, as they say, nowhere, because you came to a country that hated you from the moment you set foot here. You were placed upon a block to be sold, jeered at, hollered at, cursed at. And yet, we as a people are still here. If you had told me any other people could have existed 400 years of forced, and I mean forced, abandonment of their own culture, their own identity, and been brainwashed into a new society to accept being less than what you are. No other people on this earth could have survived. So first of all, yes, we all have to say that we are proud to have came from the depths of where we came, to look back to our original culture. And if we have to make ties to Liberia and Ghana, South Africa, any country whatsoever in Africa, and make those ties to our historically black colleges to even keep them solvent by any means necessary. There's always been an exchange between African universities and black colleges. There's always been a reach across the oceans to learn more about our history, because that's our greatness. That's how we rise. We rise because we don't forget. We rise because we want to move forward. We want to be positive. We want to energize our children to unbelievable heights in business, in education, in health, in law, so that we can change things. It's not so hard to believe that things can change when people work together. It's 40-some million of us, a small country. They will never give us a country of our own. But who's to say that we can't use the empowerment of our own wealth and start more banks and more businesses that treat you fairly on a loan, on a mortgage? You see, we don't explore the possibilities of what we can do with black wealth. And when we do, we're shut down because the other side of society don't want you to have that much wealth. Africa has a lot of wealth, and it should be making investments into our schools. There are colleges and universities all over the world with American universities on their name, with their names on them. Why can't we do the same as historic black colleges? Why can't we have satellite campuses in other countries in Africa being supported by those countries and have a program, study abroad, where they come here and they go back and give back to their communities in Africa? There are so many different possibilities that can be talked about, but we first got to get the ideas together and be willing to even discuss these things. Even though you might be a college president or whatever, I'm sure you don't think of every idea that's out there. So there are many ways that I think that we could be beneficial of our original home place, and they can be beneficial of us, and the wealth can transpire between the two. It will take forever to get the African-American population out of the belief that some of us will never have a chance. But we all can have a chance if we work together. As the other caller said, we have to work together. If we don't, then we get left by the wayside. Technology and everything else is moving ahead in this country. We don't want to be left behind. We're not getting that big bite of the apple. So that means we're only getting what they want us to get. We're only being taught, and we're only learning what they want us to learn. But there's so much more to this world to be thought about, and especially since Europe is only a few hours away. Africa is only hours away by flight. We can trade back and forth ideas and commerce and finances. But we first have to work together. And that's where I would like to see all these different colleges begin to work together with Africa, different countries in Africa, and come up with plans and programs that can benefit all the youth that are coming up for generations. And again, I turn it back to you, Slee.
Thank you, Alex. Brother Haki, where does Africa fit in solution of transforming us from this sharecropper state? Your response.
Real simple. Africa is the key to, wholesale change, political change in society. When you think about the immense wealth of Africa and the resources that it has, if we were to organize those resources under control of African people, they would have a huge say-so in terms of global affairs. In that context, keep in mind that when you talk about, this access to African resources, you're talking about power. So people in the West understand, particularly in America, understand that if Africa had that kind of power, then to subject its citizens or its people, to barbaric conditions would simply be unacceptable. And because in the context of American society where money rules everything, they're less likely to engage in discriminatory policies toward African people if they understood that if those discriminatory policies result in a response from Africa, they wouldn't engage in those kind of actions. So clearly Africa is a key in terms of overcoming, this kind of systematic injustice that African people are confronted with. And so when we talk about the functioning of historical black college and universities, and clearly if you talk about a sustained and independent, centrally controlled Africa, then clearly the potential in terms of using resources out from the continent to impact African universities here in North America is not only something that will be worthwhile, but in the strategic point, in the strategic sense of things, is very, very important in terms of ensuring that this kind of systematic injustice confronting African people will come to a halt. And so therefore, if Africa were to be truly independent, then all of these problems, all these things we perceive as problems in society clearly has the potential in terms of coming to an end. But all that's predicated on a strong and centralized Africa coming to existence. And I close with that, Brother Africa. Brother.
Thank you. Next, 6057. Your response, where does Africa come to?
Africa plays a central role, especially when it's unified and liberated under a socialist society. But even in the struggle to achieve that, if African HBCUs look to Africa more in terms of not only of what they could give, but what they could get from Africa, let's see, it would be awesome of raising the self-esteem of those Africans that are enrolled at HBCUs. And also, there would be the possibility of exchange programs between the universities of Africa and the HBCUs. That would be possible. I think the only thing it would take is, you know, some intelligentsia that would, you know, that could think out of the box a bit and have that sort of idea. And it would strengthen bonds between Africans at home and Africans in the diaspora. So I think it, there's certain barriers that would have to be overcome, they're not insurmountable. And I think it would do much culturally and psychologically for those Africans that are affiliated with HBCUs.
Thank you, caller. Let's go to 7236. Your thoughts. Where does Africa fit in the scheme of things? How can we get out this sharecropper's dilemma? 7236, are you with us?
Yes. Thank you. As one of the speakers said, the idea of having satellite campuses is a great beginning. You look at American U, it has campuses in Nigeria, in Ethiopia, throughout Africa. And if, as a coalition or federation, similar to what the universities have in the District of Columbia, they, if you're a student at Howard or a student at UDC or a student at George Washington, you can all share the facilities of the universities in common. But instead, I'm suggesting that we begin to have satellite campuses set up. And we have to deal with the economics of the continent. For example, the American University in Nigeria is owned by one of the candidates that's running for president right now. But the point is that we should have a Howard University in Nigeria, a fifth university in South Africa. We should have HBUs in Mozambique, and that would be a great way to, one, enrich our African brothers and sisters at home by having them completely finishing undergrad school, ready to attend any professional school that they wish in the States, whether it's to go to medical school, dental school, to become a lawyer, a veterinarian, whatever. They would be prepared and have those tools because, after all, the HBCUs are accredited by the same institutions as the European institutions. So what it really takes is just creative young people, young minds, to establish these satellite campuses abroad. And I think that's a wonderful thing to unite the diaspora with the people on the continent at home.
And we go to caller 4298. Your response. 4298. Response, caller 4298. Okay, while we're waiting for caller 4298, In closing out, I would like each one of y'all to respond to this narrative of the raising of capital, the raising of money for HBCU schools is not to be raised and be viewed as a means for individuals to profit or be self-centered towards their interests at the expense of the collective. That is to say, when schools are financially viable, it does not mean automatically presidents get to increase their salaries, excuse me, or board directors get to increase stipends. It doesn't mean increase of wages for individual, but it really means is having the necessary capital to have a healthy functioning institution. 1 minute response to that narrative, Brother Alex.
Yes. When we look at putting money on the table, and that's what, you know, normally we think of, we're putting money on the table to go ahead and take care of the necessities of the university, which should always come first. But the salaries that are involved now, everyone wants to get paid and to be at a certain amount of money, otherwise they will leave that institution. So when we look at people that are, say, not as committed because they are not an alumni of that school, or say they didn't even come from the United States themselves, there have been many European-American presidents of HBCUs who have paid themselves extremely well. And for a few of them, they made more salary than the other staff that was there at the school in the beginning of those HBCUs. So when it comes to recognizing the salary of what someone is worth, then that should be discussed by the board of that university and done accordingly to the school's policies. So I've always had a problem with what some chancellors made over others, and maybe they had the same amount of students involved or whatever. But yet and still, the school may lose its accreditation because so many students were failing. We can't put all of the blame on the professors who are teaching the students. We also have to put the blame in the chancellor's department also. So we need to move beyond the issue of what I'm worth or what I can get out of this HBCU and turn it around and say, what can I give to make this HBCU the best it can be? Because the students are here to learn. We're here to teach. We send them out into the world, and we get a return back from them in our communities. So I think a lot of that has been lost, and I'm waiting on the other responses. And I thank you so much, Mr. Robinson, today.
Caller 6029, your response.
I'm sorry, what's the question again?
The question is to increase capital and raise money to sustain HBCUs does not mean that one will automatically increase his salaries, whether he a president or on a board director. It doesn't mean increased money mean increased salaries. Your response.
Yeah. Well, essentially what you're raising is a very principal question. You're asking people to put the mission over the individual. Theoretically, that sounds good. In fact, if people were to do that, in fact, you could achieve great many things because effectively what you're doing is creating a scenario which says that the collective is more important than individual. And if we're going to move forward, we do it collectively. And that certainly would empower an entire community. To the extent that people would embrace such a notion is questionable. So what you're essentially asking is people to negate class. And for a lot of people, it is a very difficult ordeal to overcome. And, so they are more likely to turn to using any additional funds to those universities for the express purpose in terms of better salaries for themselves and their friends. But I generally agree with the general general tenet that if, in fact, if you use that money for the general good to achieve your mission, then it would be in the best interest of the collective if you could do so. The question is whether or not people are motivated to those ends, and I close at that.
Thank you. Call 6057. Your thoughts, 6057.
Yeah, my thought is I think it would be a good idea if people put the interests of the collective over the individual. I think it would take a serious ideological transformation of our people in order to bring that about. Because in this society, individualism is emphasized over all else. So I think it would take, a massive political education effort in order to bring about the transformation to make that sort of thing effective. But I think it could be done. I just don't think it could be done right away necessarily. But I think, it's a worthwhile effort to pursue that, and it would move us forward as a collective.
Thank you, caller. We're going to take this new caller for a second before we finish out our callers for the day. We're going to take this new caller. Your last four numbers are 4953. Welcome to MPH Radio. Our discussion is HBCUs, Stop Being Football Sharecroppers. Your thoughts, caller, 4953.
Well, my thought, it's not the student. By the time the student get to the HBCU, they've been already conditioned and miseducated or not educated before they got there. That's where the problem began. Those students are not being prepared for college, and they're being prepared in other areas like football and basketball to a greater extent than academics. That's what the data shows.
All right, thank you, caller, for your comments. We go to caller 7236, 7236. Your final thoughts.
And Mr. Robinson, what was the last question?
Last question was about developing capital and creating resources for a sovereign HBCU school or institution. Does that mean necessarily increase of salaries for presidents, board directors, et cetera? Your response to that narrative?
No, I think salaries should be frozen or set at a certain rate, and they should come in under contract, and that should be their salary. I've seen so many HBCUs, such as the University of the District of Columbia. It received a huge land grant from Congress, but you see they sold the land off, so now it's a group of condominiums. It's the Israeli embassy, it's the Kuwait embassy, it's the Ghanaian embassy, it's Intel. It was the site of Intel for a long time. And what many people don't know, UDC, being a HBCU, was very much involved, this IT department, in working with Intel in developing the technology that we use and are so familiar with every day. But no, I think those salaries should be set, and that the board and the president should not view their jobs at the university as many CEOs do, where they are, in effect, profit sharers with the corporation. So definitely salary. You should not be working at a university if your only goal for being there is money. You need to go into the private sector. not into any university job, and certainly not an HBCU.
Hey, we can try one more time. Caller 4298. Caller 4298. You'll come to 4298.
Yeah, we should try to get the schools on the infrastructure of the schools and the needs of the students taken care of before we go into salary increases, et cetera. I agree with that 100%. I want to thank you for allowing me to be on the show. Thank you.
Okay, this is MPH Radio. Our theme tonight was HBCU, Stop Being Football Sharecroppers. We're going to take a quick break with music with a message, and when we come back, we ask each one of our participants 1 minute final thoughts on today's topic. One of the most important issues that has come about as we look at this particular phenomenon is that we should never repeat this error again, and that is to allow independent schools such as St. Paul to go out of existence when you had hundreds of other HBCU schools not finding a collective mechanism to keep one of their family members afloat. It's not an issue so much of the individual school, but it's an issue for the whole collective as a people. We should never forget and repeat that error nor that lesson again. We'll be right back. We're speaking truth to power, to the powerful and the powerless. This is MPH Radio, and we will fill in our missing pages of history. We'll be right back for everyone's final thoughts. We give you the best that we have. That's right. We're giving you the best that we have. This is MPH Radio. We have been discussing the theme today, HBCUs, Stop Being Football Sharecroppers. This program comes on a bi-weekly basis under the direction of Missing Page of History, the organization, which is a 501(c) nonprofit organization. This radio program comes on every other Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, U.S. If you have any comments or would like to be a guest, we welcome you to email us at mphradio@yahoo.com. And if you'd like to share your gifts and show your love, you can send it to MPH Radio in care of Missing Pages of History, Inc., P.O. Box 277, P.O. Box 27762. P.O. Box 27782. Forgive me. Richmond, Virginia, 23261. 27782. P.O. Box, Richmond, Virginia, 23261. And at this particular time, we are closing out our program by asking the participants and the callers to give us a one mini summation, final thoughts on today's theme. We'll come back to caller 4298. 1 minute, please. Any final thoughts?
Thank you. It's been a very interesting show. I think we have to understand that we live in a capitalist system, that there is, even in China under socialism, there was gradations of salaries. Everybody didn't make the same thing. And we coming through a historically racist institutionalized system, certainly see the discrepancies in pay for pay to play, payments to the football teams, and it's a racist system, and we have to understand it for what it is. When we end this capitalist profit-driven system, it should have an impact on the superstructure, which football and sports is all part of the superstructure. Certainly it will be affected by the economic base once we socialize the system. Thank you, and have a good evening.
Thank you, caller 4298, for your participation on today's program. And we next will go to caller 7236, 7236. 1 minute, and your final thoughts.
Oh, well, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to participate, and thank you for an excellent show. But I'd also like to say that Coach Sanders, has really said what needs to be done, and that you don't take coaches to make contracts where you need to have businessmen. You don't take patent attorneys when you need someone who's skilled in your property rights and your copyright, and et cetera. So we see that we need to take a professional approach into negotiating the contract for these HBCUs in these football games. And I appreciate this program for educating us, and for Coach Sanders for educating us and bringing about a path to economic advancement for the HBCUs.
Thank you, caller. And by those been listening, let me just clarify again the corrections on how you can participate and support MPH Radio by sending your contribution, love, or gift to MPH Radio in care of Missing Pages of History, P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia, 23261. Just want to make that corrections. And also want to remind you that MPH Radio, in conjunction with the African Awareness Association, they'll be taking a tour to Cuba for New Year 2023 from January the 23rd to the 30th in honor of one of our dear members and families, Emmanuel Joyner. We encourage all supporters individuals to please consider and join us on our tour. You can find more information by contacting us at mphradio@yahoo.com, or you can contact the African Awareness Association by emailing them at africanawarenessassociation2@gmail.com. One of the last things that were on Mr. J's bucket list was to take our people to Cuba, because it's definitely a missing page. It's a missing page of our history, but an important page of our history. Come and join us. We would greatly appreciate it. Now, getting back to our final thoughts, we'll go to caller 6057. 6057, your final thoughts for today's program.
My final thought for today's program, I thought it was a very interesting lesson in our history. And as been typical of throughout our history in the Western Hemisphere, we've been used as hewers of wood and resources, but not recognized, for our contributions to human society and development. And I think a program such as this could change that perception. And in order for us to end this use of our HBUs merely as a source of labor, we need to get better organized ourselves as a people and strive for Pan-Africanism, the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism.
We also thank you, Carla, for your contribution to today's program. And there's one more announcement I would like to make as we return to Cuba before we go to our final two callers that are left, is that the D.C. Metro Coalition will be doing a program, the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, a fundraising event commemorating 13 historic days, October 16th to 29th, 1962. Their fundraiser will take place on Friday, October 21st, from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. The address of the location of the fundraiser is 4221, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce, Aggie Terrace, Northwest Washington, D.C. The name is, the address is 4221 Aggie Terrace, Northwest Washington, D.C. So you're in the area on the 21st, or if you want to come support it, please come out and support the event. For more detailed information, you can contact them at 202-503-9465 or email them at dcmetrocoalition4cuba@gmail.com. Now I'm going to caller 6029. We bring the call in. Caller 6029, your final thoughts for today's program.
Yeah, I would just add that the challenges that we confront are real. And one thing is very, very clear, that as this economy deconstructs, those challenges become much more intensive and much more extensive. So we owe it to ourselves in terms of building organizations, institutions to confront, or certainly to at least acknowledge these problems and to formulate some plan in terms of a movement forward. So without those plans, the bottom line is the situation becomes very, very dire. So those kind of things we have to implement, and we have to do them today. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Carla. And Brother Alex, like always, your final thoughts for today's program.
Again, Mr. Robinson, what can I say? You keep moving the goalpost. You brought another subject that needed to be talked about. So you moved the goalpost again on me. But this is what I expect out of you and out of Missing Pages of History, for us to learn something. And not only learn something, but to collaborate with each other, to come to a thinking of ideas that we can bring something for productive, something that everyone understands and can take back and say, hey, this is a concern in our community. This is happening to us right now. We need to make some changes. Maybe that's what it's going to take also for us, the community, to say, hey, they deserve more money than what they get. We need to stand behind Dion. And not only Dion, any other one that says, hey, we're not making enough money playing these big schools. We need a bigger check. So I'm so glad that you covered this. And you covered it from the angle that needed to be covered. Because that's where, as they say, that's where the money's at. So we have to go after the money. We can sit and talk all day long, but we need to go after the ones who decide what they're getting. And if they need better expertise, do these television contracts or however they are structured, then that's what they need to do. And go to streaming, go to more than one source. There's more than one network out here. So there are plenty of places that they can sell this great product. But for one moment, I would like to just talk about the workers, and that is the kids that are playing the game of football at these historic black colleges. And when we look at what came from there and the universities, and I just would like to say just a few of them, just like Big John Baker from right here out of Raleigh, North Carolina, North Carolina Central University, Mel Blunt out of Southern University, Steve McNair, Alcorn State, Willie Lanier, Morgan State, Art Shell, Maryland State, now Maryland Eastern Shore, Richard Dent, Tennessee State, Michael Strahan, Texas Southern, Shannon Sharp, Savannah State, and Jackie Slater, Jackson State University, Hugh Douglas, Central's Collins, Bethane Cookman, Donald Driver, Alcorn State, and Robert Porcher, South Carolina State, Ben Coates, Livingston College, Everson Walls, Grambling State. These men are the workers that were young youth, didn't have no other opportunity, most of them, but to go to a small, historic black university, paid the price on the field, moved on to the NFL. This is what we have to look at, giving these young men an opportunity to provide a better life for themselves and their families. That's about what going to college is all about. Not only the education of the mind, an education in this sense of the body also, because their bodies took the toll. The colleges might have got cashed a check, but their bodies took the toll. So let's not forget the workers that also provided the money for these schools. And as they got to the NFL, a lot of them gave back. So that's the most important thing, is giving back, contributing. And I thank for all those who contribute today. And I thank you again, Mr. Robinson, for doing an outstanding job. I appreciate it, brother.
Thank you, Alice. Thank all of our participants. Thank all of our listeners. Thank all of our friends and supporters. And we will remind you that our next program will be October the 29th at 1 p.m. Again, we also would like to remind you, come and join us on our tour to Cuba with the African Awareness Association from January 23rd to the 30th. Please email us if you have interest. That's at mphradio@yahoo.com. Or you contact the African Awareness Association at africanawarenessassociation2@gmail.com. If you happen to be in D.C. area or you want to come up on the 21st as they do their fundraisers for Cuba, that will be from 7 to 10 p.m. as they celebrate the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The address is 4221 ARGYE Turns, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more information, please call 202-503-9465 or email DC Metro Coalition for Cuba at gmail. So this is the closing of our program, HBCUs, Stop Being Football Sharecroppers. We hope this information can be used as a tool to help elevate your level of activity toward becoming more active, towards helping to uplift and alleviate depression, the oppression of our various underserved communities, as well as humanity. Remember, MPH Radio is a product for you. It's a tool that should and must be used to help advance and move all of the world forward. Until next time, we will always be with you. This has been MPH Radio. We are all here for you.
We are here. We are.